Welcome back, listeners, to the Creepypasta Book Club, the podcast where we read, analyze, and discuss significant creepypastas, no sleeps, and web horror flash fiction. Thank you for your patience during our season break, and I hope you're as excited as we are to jump into season two. We are your hosts, Jonah
and Wednesday.
And today, we are discussing parts 1 through 3 of Pen Pal. But before we get into that, we've talked a lot about having more spaces for people to create and share web horror and pasta, and to that effect, we have made a forum. We made the Vault Imaginary to facilitate horror writing without the arbitrary restrictions of no sleep, a place where people can create collaborative works like the old school Slenderman thread, where you can give trailheads for your ARG, promote your web series, share horror art and comics, pasta readings, anything and everything digital horror. We hope you can join us there at VaultI, that's VaultI.boards.net, and we'll have a link in the description for you as well. Now, back to Pen Pal. In Footsteps, the narrator begins by telling a story about a strange incident from when he was 6 years old and woke up in the middle of the woods with no explanation. There was a deflated pool float nearby, and despite the dirt and thorns, he was perfectly clean and intact. When he got home, all the lights were on. His mother was looking for him and reveals that when he disappeared, there was a note left on his pillow saying he was unhappy and was running away, which the narrator didn't remember writing. The follow-up is Balloons, which goes even further back in time than Footsteps. When he was 5 years old, the narrator did a balloon project through school where the children would write a note and attach it to a balloon with a picture of themselves and send the balloons out. People in town would find them and keep up a loose correspondence with the children. The narrator sent his with a dollar bill labeled 4 stamps. When the other children got their letters, the narrator never received one. Even when his pen pal sent an envelope back to the school, it contained no written letter or return address, only a single out-of-focus photograph. He continued receiving pictures for the rest of the year, but stopped looking at them. He took home 50 pictures by the end of the school year and stashed them in his desk at home. That summer, he and his best friend, Josh, decided to set up a snow cone stand in the narrator's neighborhood to make money. When they counted their money one day, they found the 4 stamps bill the narrator had sent months ago. The narrator took his photos out and began to show Josh before they got bored and decided to go play in the ditch. While playing, they heard rustling and strange mechanical noises and headed back inside, spooked. The narrator revisited the photos that night and realized he was in every single picture in some way. He showed his mother, who called the police. Frightened and sure that he was in trouble, the narrator fidgeted with the mail until he pulled out another photo, this time of himself and Josh playing in the ditch the day before. His mother broke down in tears as she explained that she was calling the police because the letters had no postmark. In the longest story so far, Boxes, the narrator tells the story of how he got his pet cat, Boxes, right before the start of kindergarten. Boxes was meant to be an indoor cat, but would occasionally escape and make his way into the crawl space under the house. While they were moving out, as a result of the story told in Balloons, Boxes crawled under the house again and had to be rescued by the narrator's mother, who came out shaken. She rushed the move more than a week ahead of schedule. Over the years, the narrator stayed best friends with Josh despite moving away and going to different schools, and used a set of walkie-talkies to stay in contact across town. When he was 10, Boxes went missing. The narrator convinced himself that Boxes went back to the old house where he had grown up, but his mother had told him explicitly never to go back there. They decided to sneak out and look for Boxes that night. They took a shortcut through the woods where the narrator had woken up years before, at Josh's insistence. They even found the old deflated pool toy. There was also a deep hole in the ground nearby, which hadn't been there before. The house was in disrepair when the boys arrived, and the narrator realized that even though he was told not to go and bother the new owners, there never had been new owners at all. The narrator had to crawl under the house to find Box's hiding space. Meanwhile, Josh snuck into the house itself. He found that the old clothes left behind in the move were hanging up in the closet as though they were ready to be worn. Below, the narrator found a cubby with a blanket and cat food, which he thought was set up for Boxes to keep him from escaping into the neighborhood. Josh reported that the walls are covered in Polaroid pictures of the narrator, shortly before cutting off. Someone was in the house. They hunkered down and waited, the narrator trapped in the crawl space, while the stranger moved around above him. Josh moved the board and they both ran out, but not before the stranger took Josh's picture. In the confusion, Josh dropped his walkie-talkie, and they left it behind. The narrator breaks from the narrative to say that when he told this story to his mother recently, she broke down and told him that she had never put that blanket under the house for boxes. He adds for us what he neglected to tell her. That later that day, after getting home, he heard boxes meowing and excitedly raced under his bed where the sound was coming from, only to find that his cries were coming from the walkie-talkie. Before we jump into,
I was gonna be like, hey, how was your break?
Yeah, my break was good. I'm in Australia now.
Yeah.
You guys might be able to hear, that my audio sounds like shit. Because it's very echoey.
I don't have
a good recording space. Yeah, it's like a legal thing here. No, it's I don't have like a good recording space yet, so I'm just like out in like the living room, and it's like the ceilings are really high, so it's like echoey in here. I'm gonna get something sorted out sooner or later. But for right now, my audio is gonna sound kind of bad. And also, there's fucking construction going on in my neighborhood constantly. So if you hear banging noises or like drill noises, no, you don't.
It's good for you. It's unnatural to hear studio audio all the time. Need enrichment.
Yeah, we should be having to hear bad audio more often.
It's like seeing celebrities without makeup. You need it in your life.
I was watching this, the like Ro Ramden Mr. Beast video, where she was talking about the authenticity problem, where like,
oh, I should watch that,
aspects of his production are intentionally lo-fi in order to create a sense of visual authenticity. And like, we're not doing that. We just suck. We have no money. We can't like afford equipment.
You can pretend like we are, though, so you can feel like you're a part of, like, an uber elite crowd who's doing fakey lo-fi, if that would make you feel better.
No, we're intentionally crafting this, actually, to lure you in to, like a false sense of parasociality or whatever.
Yeah, it's our full master plan, our marketing strategy.
I think if we wanted to endear ourselves to people, we'd be less annoying.
It's a part of, listen, it's also a part of the branding.
Anyway, I guess let's jump into Pen Pal.
Yeah.
First, because there's a lot to, this is sort of a break in format for us to be doing longer form stories like this and doing stories in multiple parts, and that's what this whole, like, we talked about, you know, we had this sort of arbitrary break where we're like, well, all that stuff that we already recorded, that's season one, and this is season two, and kind of the way that we're denoting that is that this, quote-unquote, season is going to be entirely longer stories that we're doing in multiple parts. So, like, we're starting with Pen Pal, which is the shortest of all of the ones that we have, and we're going to be doing it in two. But so, I'm not sure how we should tackle it, I guess. Like,
how start it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm imagining we're in chairs for this one.
How were you picturing us before? I was sitting in a chair last season.
I mean, like serious chairs, like chairs with arms, instead of like a school situation.
Well, I was in a chair with arms.
Okay, well, fancy.
I'm on the sofa now.
Oh, I'm also on a sofa right now. Imagine that instead. Like, because we discussed how it would be like, this would be like how a book club is normally done, like by chapter and stuff. And then it's going to be difficult because we both know the story, and we did take the story in three parts. So we could do, like, by chapter, our notes and thoughts during it, and then do, like, an overhead after we're done?
Yeah, like the first note that I have, I remember taking it after reading, like, less than the first whole paragraph. I just, like, had to come over and make a note immediately. Just reading that small snippet at the beginning made me think about how influential Pen Pal was on my style as like a horror writer, because this voice is like exactly in the right place for me. It's not overly flowery or pretentious, but it's not overly spare either. It gives really solid imagery and attempts a literary style without going over the top with it or going into the sort of like, I'm telling a scary story kind of voice. It feels very much like a person telling you a story if that person also has this sort of literary impulse.
I know Pen Pal is like one of the like the big ones that like you cite as like inspiration for your stuff and like something that influenced you. So that like that's exciting. I also have a really similar note at the start for it too, that very similar to like episode one, season one from the Creepypasta Book Club, Goatman, where it starts with like green text and like gets dropped. I have that note where it starts like really like familiar and then like it's like we get dropped into the story. And it does have that like that middle ground of like they're still like sharing the story with us. But it's also like you are now in a story. You are in a story situation.
Yeah. It doesn't have that sort of like campfire tale vibe that Goatman does, but it's
It's a different vibe altogether.
It's similar in certain ways because of the like the familiarity that he takes to the audience. It is aware that it is telling a story, which is not uncommon on Reddit and in terms of like No Sleep, because this was originally posted to No Sleep.
Yeah.
In when was this posted? Like
2011.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like over the years, a particular style has developed where like the authorial voice of the narrator of a typical No Sleep kind of fades into the background. The narrator is more just like a conduit for the story to be told and like to happen to, instead of being like both a character and a presence that is willingly telling you a story, like a character that takes on the duties of an author. Partly because I think Pen Pal is set in the past, rather than being like a recent event, which is usually how stories on No Sleep are framed.
Yeah. Also, like, literature inclined, but like it's like this for a reason. It's not just like this guy showing his chops off, which is like what happens on No Sleep. It's like
it's like memoir style writing almost.
Yeah, memoir style. That's really good. It's like he's relaying these things on No Sleep, which is like a paranormal space. But like instead of going to like the easy like paranormal explanation, he doesn't. And like we get the understanding that there's like he's a little aware that it's not paranormal and there's more to it. And we get that conveyed through the fact that he's telling it in this way.
Aside from the strangeness of the events of Footsteps, He doesn't do much to ever, like, imply that something paranormal could have happened with that. It was just weird.
It's like, because this is, like, the height, like, glitched in the Matrix stories, so you could easily have been like, oh yeah, this weird thing happened to me, glitched in the Matrix sort of thing, and then, like, keep going to the rest of the story. But he specifically doesn't, and it feels like, along with the way the style he's, like, doing the story in, it feels like intentional that you like you get this like shorthand, like it's not because I'm telling it in this way.
And I think also because of how reserved the narrator is with his own emotions, other than describing how he felt at the time, because he's talking about something that happened to him, especially in the first two parts, stuff
when he was like five.
Yeah, stuff that happened to him when he was 5, 6 years old, 10 in boxes, like He's described, and he is presumably like an adult man. He's moved out, and he is talking about stuff from his early childhood.
It's a really appropriate way to do it. Like, people always ham it up. Like, it's like, I guess you can be shooken, but like, you have to have like a, you can't just like post raw, like, I'm shaking and crying and throwing up right now because I have this memory. Like, you, like, introduce people to, like, the memory worldscape before we feel like that's, you know, otherwise it's going to be too much.
Corny, yeah. It also sort of doesn't overstay its welcome in terms of the actual scares themselves. Like, especially in the first three parts, there is a threat. There is, like, a clear and present threat that the narrator, as a child, kind of didn't understand very much.
Yeah.
But it sort of comes across as, like, it's not melodramatic. It just feels like, it just feels like, wouldn't it be fucked up if this happened to you?
Like, we're entering a space where we're pretending to not know. We're not trying to talk beyond what happened in the first three ones, even though we, like, know.
Yes.
So we're role-play with us, LARP with us.
As you go on reading it, it is very good at bringing up those sort of book club questions, you know? Like making you wonder, like, about the sequence of events and what's going to happen next. Because, oh, that's another thing that I noted, is that this story has an amazing sense of causality.
Yeah.
And because it is written, rather than being written strictly as a horror story, it is written as a mystery, which lends so much to it. Because, like, that's also probably another reason why I love it so much, because I fucking love mystery stories. I grew up reading a lot of mystery. If you can pull off a solid mystery structure, I will just love your story, like, automatically.
And like a lot of the horror is like dread instead of like things that aren't dread. If you figure it out ahead of time, like in a mystery, it's like the author's going to get there when the author gets there. So there's no like relief for the thing you have, that you know it's coming, because it's a story that takes place like soundly in the past.
Yeah. To bring up like a pop cultural referent that people are talking about a lot right now, the big thing on my dashboard is Andor. And I haven't watched it because I don't care about Star Wars at all. Like, with the restrictions of a prequel story, it means that everyone already knows how the story is going to end. So you have to work that much harder to make the actual content of that story compelling. The Game of Thrones problem, I guess, is avoided. Where, like, a lot of, like especially now, but it was, you know, it was definitely starting back in this, like, 2011 era, where, like, the idea of, like, fiction that is entirely dependent on the audience feeling the stakes of, or like, Walking Dead.
Yeah,
Walking
that's
Dead
good.
Was about to blow up in 2011. Like, when did it come out? Like, I think it came out in 2011, if not 2012.
That sounds believable. I believe you.
And that was the big draw for a lot of people of Walking Dead, that would then carry over into the hype for the HBO Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Was like, who's going to die? Who are you going to root for? Is your fave going to bite it? Like, that style of engagement, where, like, that is avoided in a story that takes place from a point where you know the main character, at least, is going to be all right, because he is describing something that happened a very long time ago and is not showing any signs of threatening him now.
Yeah, he has to be alive to be telling the story.
Yeah, which is, like, that's, like, one of the no-sleep rules, but, like, there's...
You hope that he's alive to tell the story.
Like, there's ways of getting around it and creating, like, present danger threat. Like, thinking about, we talked about Cabin Story. That is a story where, like, the big plot starter takes place in the past, and it is a story that's constantly looking towards Faye's past.
Yeah, yeah.
While the threat and the physical, like, body of the story is taking place in the present with the fucking, the asshole getting menaced by my husband.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like, sometimes in these stories when people, like, do, like, this happened in the past, what I mean by they're alive is, like, sometimes, like, and then I was murdered in their story is, like, an old school trope around, I guess old school is a weird thing, just, like, a thing you'd see around this time when people try to be, like, more story-y with their creepypastas instead of just, like, I'm telling you a thing that happened on a forum or whatever. Like, people didn't get, like, you have to be, like, alive to be writing this and posting this online. Like, you don't have to be for every single thing unless you're, but, like, you know, it just shows, like, not, it wasn't being thought about, like, how the story is going to be received, which says something to, like, the quality of the story that you're going to be reading.
Yeah, like the thing that creates the stakes for us in this story is not, like, whether or not characters are going to live, but about, like, because we see something horrible happening to a child.
Yeah.
Like, that creates an instant anxiety for most people as readers, either because, like, you are, like, an adult who is like, oh god, I don't want something horrible to happen to a child because, like, I'm an adult and I know that children are helpless.
Yeah.
Or because, like, you are a young person and you're close enough to your childhood where, like, I was, if this came out in 2011, I probably read it around that time. I would have been, like, 15, maybe 16 if it was, like, 2012. I could still, you know, put myself in the shoes of a young child and thinking about, like, how it felt to be that sort of, like, helpless to the world around you.
Yeah, like, I feel, okay, there's, like, stuff in the story where I made, like, anecdotal notes. I feel like the story really invites you to do that.
Yeah, to think about your own childhood in comparison to this.
And, like, hey,
I also did that. I was thinking about my childhood again.
It's totally intentional. Like, because then you drop yourself down into that kind of, like, I remember being this vulnerable or whatever because I'm being invited to reflect on my own childhood. And it's, like, because it's not, like, it's, like, not, like, there are ghosts in my house or whatever. Like, ghosts in your house is a good premise, but you know what I mean. Can you reflect back on your own childhood and, like, was something off about it? I think is what the story invites you to do in the first, like, three parts.
Because he does have that lead-in of, like, which, like, that's my least favorite part, I think, of the whole segment that we read. The part where he's like, oh, I talked to my mom about it, and she mentioned some stuff that I totally forgotten about. And it's like, that kind of sucks. Like, that's a really inelegant way of leading into the rest of the story. But you wanted to create a whole series branching out from this because it got really good reception. I understand that. Yeah. But, like,
the lead-through could be better because it also makes the mom feel a little out of character. Because later she has, like, different, she's, like, she's less abrasive than the character he presents there. And maybe, like, you could, like, swing that he makes that part up because he knows exactly the story he's telling and he didn't need to be reminded is my, was my read of that.
Yeah, like, I think that is an interpretation that you can have. Yeah. I think at least at this point. Because there's, based on the later stuff, I do think it makes sense for this to have discovery aspects to it the narrator. Because there is information that he doesn't know.
Like, here, at least.
There's a bit of sort of foreshadowing in this part. Like, having read the whole story many, many times, like, I sort of didn't pick up on it. And I don't want to discuss it right now for any of you guys who haven't, like, finished the story yet.
It hasn't happened yet. Oh, so definitely remember, because I want to know what you were like, oh, about doing this reading. It really makes it feel different, like, when you're doing it to, like, comb it over and think about the stuff.
Also because, like, I've only actually read it with my eyes a couple times. Usually I listen to it. Like, that's how I originally got it.
I think people who read it do a big disservice, because they do it, like, they deliver a lot of stuff hysterically, and, like, they comb over a lot of the finer, like, tone-wise, they're, like, incorrect with some of the deliveries, when it's clearly, like, and which muddies the story a bit, because, like, because I was, like, cleaning and stuff, so I was like, oh, I'm gonna put this on the background to be extra immersed. And I was like, oh, I can't, this is incorrectly read, I can't do this.
I haven't listened to it in quite a while. I was just, like, thinking about, as I read it with my eyes, mm-hmm. like, there's also formatting problems,
yeah.
which really, really bugged me. And, like, they kind of hadn't before, but they do now. Like, the thing with the walkie-talkie dialogue. Instead of putting it in quotes, it is all written in italics.
Yeah.
And it's like, girl, you can't do that. Like,
it was a different time.
Fucking Wild West.
People, oh man, I don't know why people, like, people used to do that. I think this was, like, briefly the time here that people used to do this with, like, thought and thinking instead of, like, which I guess can work sometimes. I don't know, people just were really into formatting at this time.
I'm a proponent of people doing thoughts as, like, third person narration. You can put a character's, like, thinky thoughts in next to the dialogue in italics.
Yeah, that's fine. It was just people were doing a lot of stuff with, like, maybe the forums all got, like, easy access code buttons instead of having to, like, type it in on, like, manually. I'm worried I'm gonna say this wrong and look silly on the podcast, but I think this is also the time people were doing, like, Zaglo tech stuff. Zalgo, yeah.
I think Zalgo came out in, like, 2006 or something.
Oh. Pen Pal feels so much older. I've said this before, I have a very, like, non-firm grasp on when things came out.
I mean, like, that's kind of a thing as well, I think. Like this period of, like, older internet pasta content feels so much more compressed in my memory, because I think just because a lot less stuff was coming out.
Yes.
Because, like, the space hadn't been, like, opened up to people yet in the way that it is now. Like, it wasn't an industry yet.
Yeah. Also, like, the slowness of the internet. Like, some of the rules in NoSleep make more sense, because, like, when a thing would come out, people would do copycats. Well, it's all very silly to try and gatekeep's a silly word for that, too. To, like, control the flow. I meant, like, literally, like, to control the flow of a story, because people will get bored with it eventually. So, like, who cares? But, like,
yeah, it's like a time gating measure.
Yeah, time gating is what I meant. Because, like, the internet was, like, a different speed, so you would be stuck with, like, a hyper-realistic Pikachu blood for, like, months at a time. But now it moves so fast it doesn't matter. It's, like, it's just there to create, like, aesthetic or whatever. 2004 is when this text creepypasta.
Zalgo?
Yeah. Zalgo.
Yeah. Yeah, Zalgo's old as shit.
I don't know why I thought... Because I guess I think Pen Pal is older than it is.
Because I remember using Zalgo when I was, like, you know, like, on like, roleplay forums as a kid and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
I don't know why I thought it was...
Is Zalgo even connected to, like, an actual story? Because I've never seen it.
Yeah.
I just know, like, the Zalgo text generator.
No, it's, like... The text is named after the creepypasta.
Okay. Because I've never seen anybody even talk about the story. It is just, like, people say Zalgo in my experience to mean, like, the text generator. Or like, the text style.
I think it's a very similar dogscape situation.
Awesome.
I don't remember the creepypasta. I know it, like, was circulating in junk, but I think it just, like, there's text and a creepypasta generated around it, but then, like, the text acquired the name because it was used there. Like, this thing cometh is from the creepypasta, but, like, people were already using the spooky text for stuff. Hey, so Speaking of a creepypasta we're not actually reading, but now the one we are, I know you had written like a lot of notes, so.
One of the things that I noted in Balloons is how solid the like time setting of the story is. Like, it's very grounded in the time and the place where the story is supposed to take place, and it's really good at working out little details of stuff.
It's like believable.
Yeah, like we know that it's in like the sort of like south of the USA, because he mentions like running to Winn-Dixie as a kid, and like and we know that it's in like the early 90s when he would have been like, you know, 5, 6 years old, because he mentions those Marvel trading cards.
But also, like, the concept of pen pals in this way is very, like, 90s. I have a story I want to share. When I was in my Catholic school, we were going to do a pen pals thing with other Catholic students in, like, Chile. And we were, like, getting ready to do it. Like, we had, like, met, we got all, like, paired up, and we got, like, stationery and all that stuff. And then, like, the whole anthrax thing happened.
What?
Like the, I don't know, like the anthrax thing.
I don't know what anthrax thing you're t like, was there an anthrax scare in the 90s?
No, well, it was early 00s. Oh, I don't know where my phone went to look it up. I thought this would be common knowledge. Yeah,
In 2000, I was four, so
I'm
it might be
sorry.
common knowledge, but I was four.
I'm sorry about you being four. Fuck, I don't know where I put my phone. I put it down for like 2 seconds and it's gone. Okay, well, Jenny, you have to look up anthrax 2000s. And people were like, oh no, well, our nation's under attack, so we can never send mail to people who are non-American ever again. And then we did do the pen pal thing.
Okay, yeah, the 2001 anthrax attacks.
Yeah.
And it was right after 9/11,
Yeah,
so that
so.
also
Yeah.
compounded the paranoia.
Yeah. So I didn't get a childhood pen pal exchange because people were patriotic or whatever.
The 2001 anthrax attacks, also known as Amerithrax, occurred in the United States over the course of several weeks. Letters containing anthrax spores were mailed to several news media offices and to Democratic senators, killing 5 people and infecting 17 others.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Like, I'm sure, like, I was aware of anthrax attacks having happened at some point in history, but, like, I didn't realize, like, when or where or how. Like,
Or
I
what,
knew in the
yeah?
US that. Because people joke about sending anthrax through the mail and stuff.
Yeah, and
Like,
it's like a plot in a lot of like cop procedurals anymore. But like, yeah, so this thing like sets this in it like a. Like, obviously, he didn't know that there were gonna be anthrax attacks. Well, I guess it already happened. So, yeah, he did know. So, this set, because this is a fantasy story, a horror story reading. So, he knew, like, he set this in the timeline that there was, like, a wall that this could not go past because, like, you wouldn't be able to do this past, like, the 90s, past, like, the.
Well, like the letters were entirely like within like a range of like a couple of towns
Yeah, I know. I'm just
around this
saying,
sort of smallish
like,
town.
I would, like, if he brought this up, like, past us, I'd be like, oh, that doesn't sound real, is what I'm saying.
I think the real cultural shift that he would have had to contend with was like the post 9/11
Yeah,
paranoia,
that
really.
too. It's both, I think. It's, like, the letters thing, because, like, people were, like, really intense about that, but also, like, setting things up in the air and stuff, and like, but also like the nearness of a neighborhood. This is like the very edge of like before like Stranger Danger got to like
Yeah,
normies.
I was gonna say, like, this was really like, cause in like the early 90s or like late 80s to early 90s, this was really like the turning point of Stranger Danger, Reagan propaganda and AIDS and stuff, like where this was like really breaking through the like cultural
Yeah,
consciousness.
so like if he's like in a small
But I think probably before, like, the 24-hour news cycle.
That too, yeah. So this is, like, the last possible year that this kind of thing could even happen. Like, realistically, in America. Like, you make up a fantasy situation where it happens.
And this is essentially a kind of... Like, this is literally a Stranger Danger story.
Yeah, yeah. Spoilers.
But it also feels like... I mean,
it's not a spoiler.
We've seen the man.
Yeah. Also, hey, this is also like peak, like, people are living in my walls creepypasta era. So it's kind of fun that it's like this, like, well put together. Because a lot of it is just like, what if there was a homeless person? What if you got so scared? To bounce off, like, what if there's a homeless person? You got so scared. The fact that he presents it as we were moving into an affluent, like, neighborhood and we were visibly poor, it creates, like, this sense of, like, right away predation. Like, there's this poor boy with, like less recourse for action. And here's this person who is probably maybe from the neighborhood, like, who has the money to be, like, have this free time to be doing these things instead of, like, a random homeless person living in your walls.
It's interesting to think about, because, like, this story, I don't think, is intending to be... It does not have an agenda with its message.
Yeah, you don't feel it.
But it does have kind of a political implication because of the fact that the story is entirely based around Stranger Danger and the idea of, like, you know, what if you were a random child and you were doing things that a child does and because of that you were targeted by a predator who became so obsessed with you that he lived in your walls and killed your cat and stuff like that.
Like, yeah, it's loaded. Like, anytime you do something like that, it's like loaded with, like, classism and stuff and, like, ableism and things like that, like, and it's unavoidable, and it's like how it's being handled.
Yeah, and also the we already know that the stalker is a man, and that inherently brings the images of gay pedophile stereotypes, but also, like, there was something I read a while ago about, like, how most pedophilic offenders with young boys identify as straight and have no, like, attraction to adult men, and it's entirely about power and the fact that they can get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like they don't see them as, like, people. They see them as, like, non-entities that they can, like, exert this power over.
And that's one thing I will say is that, like, even though it is loaded, I don't feel like, even as the story goes on, that it dives into, and in like, too much of an unsavory way into that sort of, like, gay pedophile.
Yeah, that's why I didn't bring it up. Like, it kind of, like, slipped my mind. But, like, you're right, this would automatically feel like, oh, this is a, that kind of thing. But it feels more like someone just unwell, who's used to exerting this sort of power over people, you know?
Yeah.
And which is why, like, the classism thing stood out, like, as a higher point. But, like, you're right, it is also, like, treacherous to get there. Because, like, I'll write this down. Or maybe I won't, but I'll probably remember later. Because it gets framed around something that happens later, so we can maybe bring that up more then. That feels less like the intent of the story and more just like an unavoidable thing in the story, like a culture, like there's only so much you can, like, subvert and dance around before you have to, like, confront the stereotype of it.
Yeah. The core idea of it, like, you kind of can't have one without the other if you're telling a story like this.
Yeah.
Like, like you said, it's, like, unavoidable. So, like, you can be as careful or as respectful, I guess, as possible. And it's still always going to have a little bit of that, like, that sort of instinct for people reading it.
Yeah. So it's, like, better to go in with, like, teeth and be nasty with it over, like, being overly sensitive. Because, like, what's the point of that when you know you're dealing with this sort of topic?
Yeah.
It defeats the purpose in a lot of ways.
Like, people are going to think of it
regardless.
In any case.
You can't, like, PG your way out of something like that.
Do we want to talk about, like, we both mentioned having, like, anecdotes that we wrote down because of what the time setting sort of put in mind for us.
Do we want to go by, like, part by part? Because I already got my balloons one out.
Oh, yeah, I just had, like, one sort of thought that was also from around balloons that I wrote down, that I was just thinking of. Because, like, one of the ways that you know that it was written before the 2000s, well before the 2000s, is, or that it's set before the 2000s, I should say.
It's fun that you can, like, easily be like, oh yeah, this happened before. Like, no, it's a story that he made it post-2000, but it feels so, like, it feels like a real memoir. It feels like a real thing from a real person's life, and that's, like, what makes it...
Yeah, because it has a lot of authentic detail. The fact that he could be, like, a 5-6-year-old who is just sort of, like, wandering around the neighborhood unsupervised, setting up, like a snow cone stand in the summer and stuff, and, like, talking about, like, you know, going to the Winn-Dixie and getting, like, things from the machine.
Yeah.
From the gumball machine or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's also tied into where he was living, because he mentions, like, living in, like, being like a poorer family that moved into more of an upscale neighborhood in the sort of, like, poor part of the upscale neighborhood.
Yeah.
Made me think about, because I grew up mostly in, like, suburbs. Mm-hmm. Like, when people talk about the Americana suburb experience, like, that's what I had for a lot of my childhood, because, like, when I was very young, like, my family had, like, kind of a lot of money, which we lost all of in the 2008 financial crash.
Yeah.
But so, like, for those, like, early parts of my life, we lived in a couple different places, but it was always in, like, exclusive suburbs.
Like, upscale
where it was,
cities.
Like, pure residential. You could not get to, like, a fucking corner store for a couple miles.
Oh, wow.
Like.
This is the first suburb I've ever lived in.
And like, they kind of suck in that way, because, like, it makes it hard to get places. Like, you often, like, live closer to other kids. Like when you're a child, I mean.
Yeah.
I remember, basically, because I was born in 96. So, like, very much past the sort of peak of stranger danger in the cultural consciousness, where that was, like, a big, you know, thing that parents were worried about. I was, like, I was not allowed to, like, go places by myself without, like, a friend or an adult with me. Even, like, walking around the neighborhood, I had to have an older kid with me.
There's other circumstances for why I was allowed to do this, mostly, you know.
Yeah.
But also, when I was that age, like, it was also, like, you could just do that on top of it. So, like, when you were that age, you weren't, like, allowed to go do that unsupervised, while I was, like, I could, like, walk my 6-year-old self down to the corner store and, like, make purchases and leave.
Yeah, yeah, and it really changes how independent you're allowed to be when, like, the only way that I experienced stores as a kid was, like, being taken there by someone else. And that's the way that, like, most, like, I think suburban kids experienced the store. Because, like, the suburb has a vested interest in separating its residents from public spaces. lately I've seen like more discourse around third places that this reminds me of, like the way that like the mall used to function as a social space for kids in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and that's the closest thing that you have to that kind of social space. Because, like, the social project of the suburb has always been about isolation. It's like a dividing and conquering, and because it increases your dependence and your alienation, where, like, you don't have community producers in, like you would in rural spaces, like your farmers, your artisans, and you also don't have the familiar urban communities like the kids in your building or the family-owned corner store down the block. So you rely more heavily on major corporations to meet your needs.
Which, like, and, like, so, like, people who are born completely post, like, Stranger Danger, who are, like, brought up in a suburb, who, like, if that's your upbringing and the first time you've experienced, like, independence is, like, the moment you hit 18, that's a different kind of, like, you know, like, people going into the world, like, soft and new and stuff.
Yeah, it's a very different experience.
Yeah. Versus, like, if you've been running errands since you were, like, 5 in, like, the 90s or whatever.
Yeah, like when I was a kid, I had friends who, like, I was not a very, like, independent child, but I had friends who, like, couldn't open a can of tuna
by themselves.
Or, like, couldn't... But then also, like, when the financial crash happened, mm-hmm. like, I had to become much more independent. And then we moved back to New Jersey mm-hmm. and stayed with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. It was still, like, a suburban area.
Yeah.
But like, there was stuff, like, within walking distance of me, sort of for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, was never home for 2 years. I was...
you got wings. You got... some walking stuff to do. I think it's like, yeah, like the moment people get a chance to, they often do take it, like, unless there's something like more deeply wrong going on. Like, people want that sort of independence. And like, back to the tuna can thing, when I was older and lived in like more rural places, but also like up in college, you'd meet people who like didn't know, like, things didn't come from like box made stuff, or people who didn't like I don't know. Is that really something we have to explain to, like, someone who is, like, in their 20s that, like, you can just make a cake? You don't have to use a box kit or, like...
Yeah.
Or, like, food comes from several ingredients you can just buy yourself and it's not always, like, made by someone for you.
Yeah, or, like, meat comes from an animal that people kill and, like, you can get a piece of meat raw.
Yeah.
I've met so many people who have never... cooked meat, not because they're like vegetarians or whatever,
but
they have never had meat that was not like pre-cooked to throw in the microwave or the oven or something.
Yeah, like I've met people who just like the freezer meat thing, but also people who've never, but like people who have like their food always cooked for them, like someone else just always does it.
Yeah,
so that it's like a similar mystery, even if it's like fresh food, like like, no, people have to, like, butcher this thing. People have to, like, make sure it's clean and stuff.
And it brings up sort of, like, any sort of story that is about... Because this is a story about Americana. Mm-hmm. In the way that a lot of the stories that we read in season one... Mm-hmm. were about the internet, because they were stories that, like...
Before the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Like, this is a pre-internet story. So it is about the thing that we had before the internet.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, and this presents, like, a really nice, like... He's creating, like, a child who would live at this time. He's given us, like, a lot of key points. He's avoided, like, cliche lemonade stand, but we do get a stand in, the front yard, which was, like, you know, that's a cliche American-y thingy.
Yeah.
We get, like, they, like, rolled around in, like, a ditch.
Yeah, they played mud and, like, there's, like, the deflated pool toy.
Yeah, it's so iconic. And like he also breaks a limb before school and gets a cast, which like is a really like big iconic thing in America for some reason. Like there's a big fixation on writing like about kids' cast stories in our media. And we get that too. We get the walkie-talkie thing, which is a big thing. We get like a bunch of references to like trading cards and like trading phenomenon in America, kids' toy stuff.
And it's about community in like literally his group in kindergarten, their theme is community. So they have to do this pen pal project. It's sort of like the Halloween thing, right? This thing that is attacking the narrator or following the narrator is a product of the environment that the narrator lives in. It is a product of his surroundings. It is like a bad seed that is grown in this soil.
Like stuff like that is so like the suburban paranoia that like everyone outside your suburb is going to get you, and the fact that he acquires this like stalker as they move into the suburbia is like a big thing, I think. But it's also sort of like because the stalker is presented in this way as a threat from within suburbia and not from like without, it's like a moralistic take because like people move here because they feel safe, but like the people who move to like suburbs often move because they're cutting themselves off from like the greater city community.
Like the white flight phenomenon.
So like what kind of caliber is a person who has sought isolation in the first place? Like you're not safe just because you moved here.
Yeah, the illusion of safety, because the urban environment is so like maligned in our like so much of our horror that isn't rural horror specifically tends to be about like the and also rural horror. Most rural horror right now is dog shit, like absolute dog water.
Most rural horror are written by people in the city, but they don't live in the major cities, so they act like they're in the rural. Like, no, just 'cause you live in a major city in Georgia doesn't mean you live in the rural mountains. I'm sorry. You live in fucking Atlanta.
I've never lived in like a real rural area myself, like Michigan, where I just moved out of. We're in an area that is sort of like suburban verging on rural, but it's more just like dilapidated all around.
It's unfortunately
'Cause
urban
it's Michigan.
decay.
Not even urban. Like I wouldn't consider
Michigan blighted.
It's just Michigan.
And just like, and like why I speak about like rural stuff is like because like I lived in like a village with like 300 people and then like a town with like 1,000 people for a few years of my life respectively, and it's just like I don't know, appropriative seems like an incorrect word, but it's like voyeuristic. It's like poverty voyeuristic from people who do these rural stories and live in like relatively big, if like economically depressed cities. Like, man, that sucks. I'm sorry. You're like one step away from doing like albino hillbillies. Like, it's not highbrow just because you add like a lot of lighting and filter to it, or like are writing it in like the accelerated, like weird job style. You're just being janky. These aren't your stories to tell.
People have a certain idea about what people from certain parts of the country look and act like, and they are just like willing to be loudly ignorant about it, like.
It's also like people like rely on cliches a lot without realizing they're doing it when they do stuff like that too. And like pen pals feels really like affluent suburb space, but it also doesn't seem like it's not like he doesn't it's not an inner city, it's not like a deep city, it's like kind of like the space in Michigan is kind of like I imagine where it is, but like south and, like, not blighted by...
Oh, yeah, 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 because you've been to the area where I live. Like, or lived.
Yeah, and let me say, I've also lived in, like, really blighted American cities, so, like, it wasn't really shocking or anything. It was really nice. But, like, or, like, comparatively nice, you know, it's still, like, icky. Like, I don't know.
I mean, I didn't take you, like, when you came to visit me. Like, there's some bad places in downtown, like, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think would probably be comparable to Erie, to be honest. It's...
Like, I went to, you know, university in, like, there's a lot of places that I'm, like, I have relatives who are, like, oh, like, I wouldn't even drive into,
and oh, it's yeah, like, that sucks.
Just don't leave your car doors unlocked. You're fine. Like,
don't be a baby.
It's not safe for residents because of the atrocities.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you're systematically being attacked. Like, yeah.
But you don't live there. You're driving through. You don't drive like a nice enough truck
for them to
want to fucking...
That's really arrogant of you. You have to have a car people don't want to strip. Loser.
The only people stealing my hubcaps are the fucking people at the auto place. Whenever we take it to get the engine checked and stuff, another fucking hubcap goes missing.
They're selling it for metal prices. You're like, oh, it's a fucking choice hubcap.
It's not even the auto place. It's like it's the place where my mom actually works. So that's why I can call them lazy, because I fucking worked with them before. Like,
you know,
I used to work there.
Insider knowledge about their work ethic.
They're a bunch of pricks.
Which, you know, I think it's probably a valuable trait to have if you're at a car dealership. You want the whole package. People go there to get, like, fin dommed and stuff. Hey, so pen pal?
it wouldn't be the book club if we didn't get off on, like, a wild tangent talking about what the fuck ever for, like, 20 minutes.
I think it's valuable to the story. The intent of the story.
Yeah, the story is inviting us to do that.
Oh, welcome that for us to have done that.
I don't have a lot of focus on boxes in my notes. Mm-hmm. I think because I just sort of got, like, pulled in, was just, like, reading it.
Vibing,
like,
at the point.
I pulled out one quote that I really liked. Mm-hmm. Which was, from a distance I could see my old climbing tree, and as my mind raced the steps of causality backward, I realized that I wouldn't be back here this night if that tree hadn't grown, and I was briefly in awe of how all events were like that.
Oh my god, yeah, that's like a codex. Codex, that seems like a silly word to use, but that seems like a codex for the whole story, like a statement thesis, like...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's really strong.
Like, that's the other thing that I noted down. That I was like, this is only halfway through the story, like, mm-hmm. a little less than halfway, but this is why pen pal affects me so much, because it is a story about fate and inevitability and how, like, he is like narrativizing mm-hmm. these events. He is creating a story out of them. That's one thing I wrote down that I want to, like, read out in full, because this is what I was thinking about. That there is a storytelling ethos recently that leans towards extraneous detail and fluff, and, like, this sort of idea of, like, real-life authenticity mm-hmm. of how sometimes shit just, like, happens. Mm-hmm. But that I think that is fundamentally wrongheaded about what storytelling does mm-hmm. and is for. Because a story is inherently inauthentic because it is narrative. And good narratives that tell good stories are tailored.
Yes.
And we can tell there's stuff going on in the narrator's life outside of the story that he's telling. But the purpose of Pen Pal is to tell us a mystery story about things that happened in this person's life. Mm-hmm. So everything in the story serves that narrative mm-hmm. in some way, to create atmosphere, to foreshadow something, to, like, build themes or resonance. Mm-hmm. Like, nothing is in here that doesn't do something meaningful. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a lesson that more authors need to take mm-hmm. from mystery fiction. Mm-hmm. Because that is what I think separates mystery from a lot of other genres is the tightness of yes. causality of mystery. Because mysteries do not function unless you maintain that through line mm-hmm. of causality.
I agree with, like, that completely. I think, like, the, like, mumblecore, whatever the written version of that is, or whatever, yeah. is really, like...
I just call it mumblecore.
Yeah. Like, you can do that, but you have to also have foundational skills first. Like, Pen Pals would be a weaker story if there was a lot of, like, divergence into here and there, and, like, non-sequiturs. Yeah. Like, the appeal of stream of consciousness to a lot of writers... is, like, the lowered bar. It's, like, the free verse. It's, like... and, like, that's fine, but the reason why a lot of those things resonate with people is because the person already has foundational skills that they're now growing on and developing their own voice from. If you don't know how to, like, trim, if you don't know, like, the function of the fluff, people aren't going to be into your thing as you're into it. It's not funny or quirky or interesting or whatever to have a bunch of stuff in between that has no purpose, because the reader's going to feel frustrated, they're going to feel like their time was wasted, they're going to be confused, it's going to muddy your story.
You know what I was thinking of, actually, when I was writing that note?
Oh, what?
Homestuck.
Yeah.
Listen. Because that is, like, Homestuck is really... interested in causality, but it is mm-hmm. also very interested in horseshit. And there is no distinction made between like what is horseshit and what is
important,
valuable to the chronology of the story, because everything is potentially
everything's important. We were talking recently about it, and it's like you don't know when a bit is a bit that's goofing about for a really long time, because, like, in 200 pages, that thing you kind of, like, glazed over is now, like, vital lore that you need to understand, to understand, like, entire hundreds of pages more. And, like, oh, you fucked up, now you have to go back and look at stuff.
And that's also a thing that's compounded by, like, the length of the thing. Where, like, I don't understand why so many writers pat themselves on the back for writing sheer... word count. Uh-huh. And this is not just me being bitter as someone who writes slowly and doesn't write a lot, because I write very laconic. I'm not interested in writing as many words as possible, because I believe deeply in the idea that there is, like, a right way mm-hmm. of saying the thing, and that you should only use that many words to say it. You should mm-hmm. never say more. You should try not to say less.
Mm-hmm. Like, just right. Like, okay, we are sitting in the club room right now doing NaNoWriMo.
Mind Palace.
In our Mind Palace, where I envision us in, like, the sitting room, like, that room in a library where they keep for, like, meetings and storage is where we're at right now. And it's, like, NaNoWriMo season right now.
Yeah. We're recording this dead in the middle of November.
Yeah, so, like, it's sort of like this writing culture that already existed before this, obviously, but, like, that really, like, grew from that kind of, like, culture around it. I don't know, it's like a production. It's like, people don't know what they're doing with their words. Like, you'll get people who are like, I wrote 10,000 words today, but, like, was it of substance?
Yeah, and people will say, like, well, that's not the point of NaNoWriMo. It's not to write 50,000 plus good words. It's to write the 50,000 words. Yeah, then that's a waste of time. Like, I think a lot of it goes to Stephen King, because there's a mm-hmm. lot of authors that are very, very, very prolific and write very quickly and publish books at the fucking speed of light. But a lot of them, like James Patterson, just uses ghostwriters. He doesn't actually write anything himself. Stephen King writes like a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
But most of what he writes is... it's bad. Like, it's not good. Bad. It's, like, unreadable.
Like,
because he doesn't self-edit. He does not have a filter. He just writes down what he is thinking...
he can get away with that because he has money. Like,
and like some of his stuff does work and does resonate. Like, I still really like mm-hmm. Carrie a lot.
If you write a lot, some of it's gonna be good eventually. I guess is the thesis. But
yeah, like, it's monkey's typewriters.
Yeah, but like, hey, what if you like developed your craft instead of like hoping to bang out a good one? Just saying. If you were a woodcarver, you wouldn't be like, I got in 10,000 wood chips today. You'd be like, I finished some pieces today. Like,
because Stephen King is the model for a successful mainstream author, mm-hmm. everybody wants to be Stephen King. Everybody wants to, you know, put out the 200,000 word epic.
I don't think the world can handle more than one Stephen King. It's alarming. But also, I guess there's the YA thing, where a lot of the YA books are just terminally long, so the Stephen King's for, like, the guys, and, like...
Well, I mean, like, because Stephen King is sort of, like, the blueprint, and then it expands out into, like... I was about to make a joke about Harry Potter, and about how those books got, like, terminally fucking long, and how I think that is also, like, another symptom. Like, that plus Twilight, which were also fucking long books.
That's what I was going to say. Like, Twilight is, like, the gold standard. Like, people don't really think about it as that, like, but, like, maybe in the recent times people were like, Twilight's my goal, but, like, Twilight's, like, or what are the fucking, those, like, city, like, supernatural fae books, like...
Oh, City of Bones. The Cassandra Clare books.
Yeah, I think that's people's, like, gold standards recently for, like, word countage and word volume.
Yeah, I never even touched those books because they looked like trash to me even in middle school. I was also, like, I was, like, an edgy kid who was, like, too good for mainstream literature and I would only read weird adult books.
But, like, that was good for you.
I mean, probably, because I'm not still reading YA as, like, a 20-something adult, so. Sort of adjacent to that, and sort of adjacent to other stuff that we have been talking mm-hmm. about, the theme running through this of, like, mm-hmm. the way that parents try to protect their children from mm-hmm. knowledge.
Yeah.
That's another one of those things that really, like, rings true in a, mm-hmm. in, like... rings true, but, like, to the extreme where it's almost exaggerated, where, like, this woman never told her child that there was a man living under their house.
There's, like, a kind of, like, a sense of embarrassment that she had, like, allowed this to happen. I made this note early on is sort of, like, we know she's a single mother, right? And we know, like, she has custody, like, full custody of her son. We don't really get mentioned of, like...
Yeah, I don't think the father ever gets mentioned.
Yeah, and he has a bunk bed and stuff, which, like, that's cool. Like, she's a nice mom, but, like, is there, like, more to that? Like, there's a lot of stuff that, like, we don't get touched on, and it feels like the reason she doesn't share this with, like, she doesn't, like, do more reasonable actions is that maybe there's, like, a, like, she has stuff that happened that she's, like, embarrassed about. Like, is there, like, the fact that he does have a bunk bed, the fact that they did move already in this way? Like, maybe he has, like, a sibling he doesn't remember. Maybe there is, like, weird dad stuff, and then she assumed it was that first, but because, and that's why she, like, held off for so long. Like, there's unsaid, like, mom stuff that you can draw connections to that feels like the reason she acted the way she did was because of, like, pre-existing stuff.
I feel like there's definitely unspoken stuff going on with the narrator's mom. Mm-hmm. I don't think I brought it to that kind of conclusion, mm-hmm. where it was, like, that she was hiding this because there's something in her past that she's trying to hide from him that is potentially related to this. Mm-hmm. So much as, like, the way parents are, I guess, made to feel like failures.
Yeah, that's good, too.
For being single parents, or for, like, being poor while trying to raise a child,
mm-hmm.
or for, like, if anything ever happens to your kid, because, like, because of, like, the way the nuclear family is supposed mm-hmm. to work.
Yeah.
Is that, like, the child is your sole responsibility.
He really sets the mom up to be, like, a character who fits, like, all these, like, she's not the kind of mom people want to move in a suburb in, like, a fantasy American dream sort of thing.
And she seems like a nice person.
It's cool, like, the dichotomy of, like, she's, like, a good mom from what we see. Like, especially, like, she's, like, attentive and caring, and then we get, like, she doesn't check off, like, the suburb check boxes of, like, what a mom should be according to people who live in, like, a white picket fence suburb, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, the South and stuff.
Yeah. And even though she does try to be attentive, especially after she finds out about what is going on, like, when mm-hmm. they get the photos and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Or, like, to boxes, like, when she goes under there and sees that someone is living under their porch, she's like, oh, we gotta go right now.
Like, she reacts in sensible ways to protect her kid, mm-hmm. but there's also a lot of, like, the way that adults kind of don't pay attention to what kids are saying.
Mm-hmm.
Like the part in Balloons where he's, like, trying to tell her about the project, and she's like, uh-huh, that's nice, sweetie.
Yeah.
Until she realizes that's something actually serious, but then,
mm-hmm.
even when she does jump into that sort of protection mode, she ends up making it worse because mm-hmm. she is withholding information from him that if he knew it, he would protect himself more.
Yeah, we also get this really early on, too, is that he brings up, like, hey, I'm hearing, like, footsteps, but, like, he frames it, like, because he doesn't understand what he's hearing because he's, like, 6'2", and, like, her instinct isn't being, like, oh, my child is telling the truth, literally, it's to, like, baby him, like, to humor him, like, to do the ear thing and stuff, instead of being, like, wow, this is, like, a thing I should maybe be more concerned about. It reminds me a lot of, do you remember there was a post that was going around for a while that was like, oh, I didn't believe my child that there was an opossum in the room, and here's the opossum?
I do not remember, but, like, I can imagine it, definitely.
I'm gonna cite it, and we're excited, like, down in the opossum post.
But yeah, and it's not, like, it's not neglectful, and it's not even necessarily irresponsible, because,
no.
like, you know, kids do say the darndest things, as they say.
Yeah, like you can't, like, hyper-react to everything a child says, because then you, like, teach them anxiety methods that are, like, inappropriate to, like, you know?
But then also, like, it is a good lesson to, like, if, like, to at least be listening and, mm-hmm. like, acknowledging what your child is saying, like, when you mm-hmm. can. Or, like, to
yeah.
acknowledge what a child is saying. Like,
yeah.
if you're a non-parent adult who is, like, in an authority position. Like,
there are the horrors.
Hey, the teacher was checking the pictures.
Yeah, and, like, was like, well, this is weird. Well, not my job. Bye. Like,
yeah.
Hey, get back here.
Yeah, it was just, like, I guess not paying attention to the fact that some of them really clearly had this child in the picture, because it was just like, oh, these are weird pictures that this kid is... And, like, the fact that this kid is continuing to receive 50 letters, there is, like, an adult here who should have been able to spot
yeah.
something was wrong.
You know, he mentions it all in Pen Pal. Like teachers are often, like, major enablers for, like, this kind of thing, because they just, like, clock out. Which is like, hey...
Or major enablers for, like, abuse.
Yeah, that's
general.
What I mean.
Not this specific kind of thing.
No, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, this is, like, in the story, but, like, in real life, like... But the fact that this teacher did think about, like, the risk factor, even, like, this is, like, the early 90s or whatever time it is, and it's, like, pen pals and stuff, this seems like a fun thing. Like, I think, like, a responsible person would be like, hold up now. What are the negatives of this outcome, even though we're, like... Because, like, we're still past, like, the 70s and the 60s, like, when Stranger Danger would have been, like, circulated among this teacher's age group. And, like, I think even common sense is, like, let me have children put, like, their addresses and junk into, like, balloons and, like, whatever. I think there are better ways to have done this. It's my personal opinion. If this teacher was, like, a real person, if we were discussing, like, a true crime case or something.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, now, if you were to do something like this with, like a class of young children, it would be definitely prearranged mm-hmm. with someone in the community.
Who oh, is, yeah.
Like, rather than it being, like, sent randomly through the balloons, the kids mm-hmm. would just, like, get a pen pal. And even if you wanted to, like, you know, send the balloons off, because, like, a five-year-old isn't gonna know, like, if they just, like, write, yeah. like, a letter in an envelope and send it to their pen pal.
That's gonna be like magic.
Oh, you found a pen pal who's sending a letter to you, and you're gonna keep up a correspondence that's mediated through the school. You know, a five-year-old yeah. doesn't know.
Hey, it's kind of insane that this doesn't happen. I know it's a fictional story, and stuff. Like, I feel like there's some steps. It's also because, like, he's framing it in, like, this suburb where this would this, like, semi out of the city suburb kind of space where this kind of thing happens because they're, like, soft and foolish and stuff and think they're safe because they're, like, white and have money. But, like...
Yeah. That's the thing I was going to say is because they think that the space that they live in is safe and that's why they've moved here.
But it's like, hey, I think this is why people get eaten by, like, cougars when they go hiking for the first time. They leave their, like, little suburb and go hiking into, like, various mountains and then get devoured by creatures. But, like, the creatures are, like, in your community. And that's the story.
Well, it looks like we're going to wrap it up there for tonight. It's good to be back. Let us know what you thought of this episode and of Pen Pal. Give us a like and share us with your friends. Next episode, we're going to be wrapping up Pen Pal with parts 4 to 6. This has been the Creepypasta Book Club. Thank you, and good night.